We are here in what I have said is a modern Mexican restaurant. The owner, entrepreneur, designer comes from a family that has been in the restaurant business for over 100 years. And let me describe a dish that I ate here that was beautiful and horrifying.
This is Harry Hawk, and this is Talking About Everything. Nicholas and I have been talking about the historical central district of Mexico City. And Nicholas, as we said just a minute ago, we kind of want to talk about food and ingredients because I understand now where I am and the transformation that's happened only in the last couple of years. So how can we do that?
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the specific place we're in. We are here in what I have said is a modern Mexican restaurant, but the owner, entrepreneur, designer, and brains behind this place comes from a family that has been in the restaurant business for over 100 years. In fact, around the corner is a place called Café de Tacuba, which is an institution beloved by Mexicans. It opened in 1912, and it's still there. It's actually connected to this building. But Juan Pablo Ballesteros, who is with us here today, is not a chef, but he is an entrepreneur, and he knows about food and he knows about restaurants, and he decided to do something different and new in this new revived historic center. So I'd like to introduce Juan Pablo.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Harry. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure.
So tell me a little bit, Juan Pablo, about what you decided to do. What brought you into this?
Well, actually, it was partly the vein that you actually just mentioned, the restaurateur vein that my family had for I'm fourth generation of Café de Tacuba. So I had this inspiration, and I've always had a life of good Mexican eating. And we are honored to present traditional Mexican cuisine to the world in this way. I thought it was about time that downtown Mexico City had a place that was contemporary in that way. It was modern, contrasting. It was, some people called it the rebellious son of Café de Tacuba.
I should add that Café de Tacuba is a very traditional restaurant.
Juan Pablo was the first one in.
And Juan Pablo was just about the first person to take advantage of that need to bring a new kind of place back to the center. I think it's the first restaurant of this level to have opened in this area in decades. Isn't that true?
Well, I like to think so. Actually, just like you said, we thought it was a bit risky, but eventually the Mexico City's downtown needed a place, this idea, which is modern and much more focused towards craftily made dishes and artisanal drinks, and to really get away finally from all of the monopolies that constantly bombard us with their media and their brands and whatever. And then it was
large national brands.
Exactly. Or just the sponsors in Mexico, they're, you could say, a bit aggressive. So they really talk you into having a sponsorship of some kind. You could say beer, you could say drinks, you could say something else. And that leaves you with all of the limitations for your clientele. And we wanted something very authentic that we could keep on changing, we would keep evolving, and that will fulfill Mexican palates and foreign palates as well. And it would be showing some of the immense richness of Mexico, this array of flavors, ingredients that we have.
I'd like to dive into that a little bit. I don't know that people listening fully understand when you say that everything's from Mexico, they understand it's a big country, but they think, oh, you must get this from France, or you must get this from the United States. And we also talk about local. Every city has kind of a different definition of local, because if you're in Alaska, you kind of almost have to bring something in. But when you're in New York, you need a 300-mile radius and so forth. But if you can talk about how you went about finding the ingredients and the kinds of ingredients and relationships that you have or had to create to find the ingredients. And I think that would be really fascinating.
It was a bit difficult that in the beginning. We tried to find all of these ingredients that we wanted to reunite in a different manner. And it was all of these things that are dusty and unused in these different towns of the country. At first, it was a bit hard to find them, but then people knew that we were doing exactly what many people wanted, just to show them and to offer them in a much more innovative or original way. So every ingredient is traditional and Mexican, but our dishes are the result of the creativeness of the kitchen or whatever is it's contemporary, it's modern, it's different. So it was then that people came to offer them. Just, we were receiving all kinds of...
Can you list a few or categories of things? I mean, I'd like to get very specific if we can.
Oh, definitely. We actually started making, for example, mortar salsas tableside. And then we got all of these different species of chilies coming from all over the country. And then you got to pick your ingredients and local market ingredients to choose from. And it was just fresh. Later, we knew how important was the fisherman's market in Ensenada. And this is the fresh fish that we're getting, you know, the usual catch of the day that you get to see, you know, all of the time in New York, for example, that it wasn't really popular here. And so we were flying the fish over and having this occasional menus of the seasonal ingredients, which in Mexico wasn't really something very respected. Mexican people want everything all year. They don't give time for ingredients or for animals or for anything to have its be at its prime, have a good population. We want everything all the time.
But let me add something. There is a history going back to the Aztecs, going back to Montezuma, of ingredients being brought into Mexico City, right where we're practically where we're sitting. Before the Spanish arrived, they had a system of canals, of porters who brought game from the mountains, fish from the seas. It's always been brought here. It's not like a new thing. Now we have new technology. We have airplanes. But as I said before, there's an amazing array of ingredients in this country, and we're so lucky to be able to have access to it all now.
Exactly. And it was about times that many chefs and people came to realize the cornucopia of ingredients that we have in the country.
I mean, one of the things you mentioned, people want everything all the time. And so I go someplace with a friend and they may say, oh, they're out of that. And I get very upset because I say, this is great. This is amazing. If they're out of it, it means that they didn't buy 1,000 of them or 10,000 of them and stick them in the freezer. They bought what they thought they could sell. They ran out because it was popular, and they ran out because the quality is high. They couldn't, trust me, they could make sure they never run out. Do you agree with that?
Nobody ever really sees that you see behind the, we run out of it. Yeah, we try to get this ingredients and have an occasional and seasonal menu so that we can offer freshness and also what I was talking about, local ingredients. So first came the chilies, then the insects. All of the insects were really, how would you put it, stigmatized, or people were looking at it in a different way. It was visual impact, and people didn't want to eat it because of some psychological thing, but they have been here with us for a lot of centuries, and it was our most important, biggest contribution to the world's gastronomy. It was insects.
And let me describe a dish that I ate here that was beautiful and horrifying at the same time. It was served for the first time at a big business dinner that Juan Pablo did for me here. And it was called cocopaches sobre ravioli de flor de calabaza, which is, cocopaches is a kind of insect. It looks like a big, kind of a black beetle. It's about an inch and a half long. And the ravioli were really squash blossom flowers filled with cheese. So they were kind of normal and beautiful orange, yellow colored. And these cocopaches looked like giant cockroaches. They were huge and shiny and black. And it was a beautiful thing, but kind of terrifying. And I was afraid to bite into one of these things. And I thought the juice was going to squeeze out and it was going to be really gross. But they were deep fried. They were kind of hollow inside. They had a wonderful, very light, crispy texture. They had kind of an aroma almost of cinnamon a little bit, I think. They were very earthy tasting. And after you get over yourself and you realize that food is food and there's no reason to eat one thing or another thing, you just get over yourself and you can appreciate how wonderful these things are. And it's part of Mexican gastronomy. It's part of a lot of gastronomies, a lot of cuisines around the world, eating insects. And perhaps it's the future. Right now, it's something that's kind of fashionable amongst the chefs in Mexico because they're reaching back into their past and bringing these things into a new kind of postmodern context.
So Juan Pablo, a list. What are the insects that have made their way to your menu?
It depends on the month of the year, but we've had the cocopaches just as described. That time I gave you roaches. I'm not sure if you realize that. That's the reason you didn't like them at first. Just kidding. We usually carry those types of insects, and we don't get to see them in another... Well, I haven't seen them in another restaurant. So it's something that towns, they use them, but we have our own recipe for you to explore that flavor. And we've had escamoles. That's something that a popular dish. We've had chinequiles.
Ant eggs.
Ant eggs, yes, exactly. Chinequiles, which is a type of...
A grub.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then we've had humiles.
Which are little creepy crawly gray bugs.
It's a chinche.
Yeah. But all these things come from tradition. These are not, Juan Pablo isn't out there in the street like catching things with a net. I mean, all these insects have been eaten in Mexico for hundreds and hundreds of years. And you're just sort of bringing them back into contemporary fine dining context.
They are the protagonist of the dish, but we do make the compliments, offer them in a visual, more attractive, appealing way. We've had ahuautle, which is another strange one, which is the eggs of the mosquitoes, like the larvae, which sounds really not so very tasty. But once you get to try them...
Well, you talk about eggs and things, and of course, we eat eggs. We eat these things in other contexts. The comedian, whose name I cannot remember at the moment, said once, the bravest man in the world is the guy who looked at a cow and said, I'm going to go up there and I'm going to drink what comes out of there. All of our food is strange until it's not strange. My question is, so then knowing that you want to bring these things and find them and people are finding you and all that, but I mean, I know, again, in context, the Backstage Cafe that I set up on Governor's Island, we had a local farm on the island and we made a relationship. Are there bug farmers, bug raisers? Is there a family that's been doing it for 100 years? Or did you have to convince somebody to go into business to sell it? Or what is the process of finding that supplier?
Just like Nick said, it's been centuries that these people have been selling them and catching them. And you get to see the videos, and there's a lot of people that actually know where to look for them and exactly when. There's different techniques to grab either the larvae of a butterfly or the ant eggs, which are laid in the shadows of a big plant. And then you go and filter the dust and the whatever's left on the ground, and you end up with the eggs. And so you have techniques, seasons, and people that have been doing this for centuries, and that they have been eating it for a lot of time due to proteic reasons, to the impact that you have on the soil, on the earth, and the difference that is to raise cattle or to catch bugs, which is very different in sustainability.
But the irony is that now these things are kind of expensive. They are not really so popular anymore because they're these artisans and these specialists who raise them. I'd like to add that that's only one aspect of your restaurant. We don't want to scare people away here. They have chicken, they have beef, they have pork, tacos, these beautiful artisan tacos made with corn tortillas, organic corn grown in this area. There are small providers who are working with restaurants, especially in the metropolitan area now, who are providing all these things from chickens to beef to game animals and vegetables, exotic vegetables, as well as these indigenous products that are being revived and saved.
Then what I wanted to just confirm, so then most of these insects aren't farm-raised, they're foraged wild.
Both. I mentioned like six, but we also have grasshoppers, which are really popular. They're not so strange anymore. You can go to any market in Oaxaca or many other places and you'll get to see mountains of it. Just take a bag and eat them like chips. So that one can be grown or...
In the farm.
You could say that. And then some other ones are wildly catched, like, for example, chicatanas, which is my favorite one. These winged ants, they come out in rainy seasons, especially in Oaxaca. They're big, they're black, and after the rain, something happens to them. They become like clumsy, and they fall to the floor. It could be in the woods, it could be on the streets. I've seen them grab them on the streets of any town, and they are quite expensive. What's particular about them is that they have inside of their body the same molecule that makes chilies spicy, which is capsaicin. What's funny about it is that they sort of spice, they tickle your tongue, not in the same way as chilies, but that is the reason that they put it in a sauce, and the flavor is just amazing. And they only come out June, July, for example, then that's when we have them. Just like Nick said, I don't want to scare people away. We have every sort of thing on the menu.
That's what I really like to run down. I mean, you're getting artisanal chicken, artisanal pigs. Are there particular breeds? Are there particular heirloom?
When it comes to meat, we do have meat from organic ranches, which is the breed is called Charolais. It's a European breed. Also a mixture of Angus and one Brazilian one called Brangus. We haven't explored the market of organic meat and how to keep all of the soil without the pesticides and to keep on changing the animals and the compost in order for us not to use any chemicals and complete the cycle. And that's what we're distributing here. And we actually have another restaurant that focuses on just organic meat, but this is where it came from. This is where we cooked the idea. We've been having these types of meat, even if it's lamb or mutton or rabbit, pork. That is where we specified on this.
You just mentioned mutton, which is, this is a big thing that gets me upset in New York, because you'll see it on the menu and then no, it's just lamb. I have a friend, Zach Palacio, has Hudson Fish and Game, and the Nouvelle Cuisine got rid of things like hanging duck. But he's gone back to his farmers. He moved from Brooklyn out to the country so he could be near the farmers, and he's hanging ducks for 6 weeks. A little bit expensive. So you mentioned mutton. Are there things that are aged or cultured or cured in ways that are very traditional that you could mention?
Definitely. All of our meat, it's aged for either 21 up to 35 days. And that way it's a lot of qualities. The softness, the punch of flavor that you have on meat when it goes through that process. When it comes to mutton, for example, we use that in even what we call tacos de canasta, which is like a sweaty taco inside of a plastic bag that people on bikes sell on the street. And they use mutton. And it's much more strong in terms of flavor, aromatic. It's like aggressively aromatic. Yeah, but we get to mixture it, and it's an acquired taste. But once you get to like it, you love it.
In Mexico, we eat everything. We eat the whole animal. And there isn't really such a thing as lamb, because what they call lamb or cordero is usually what in the United States or England you'd call mutton. It's big and it's stronger. And every single part of the animal is eaten and used, from the head on down to the tail and the foot.
The whole beast.
The whole beast. So some of the dishes on your menu, for example, are tacos. But the idea of eating a taco, of serving tacos in an elegant restaurant is something really new. 20, 30 years ago, it would have been unheard of. Taco was something you ate on the street. A taco was something a poor person would eat. And in elegant households, they strove for French style and European style. But that's all changed. So Juan Pablo, and is one of the first people, one of the first places in Mexico City to be offering a taco tasting, a degustación de tacos, which is a tasting of tacos. And these tacos are based on very traditional tacos, but are more sort of chef-created, interesting, postmodern ideas of what a taco is. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. We started with one a month. So on the seasonal menu, we used to introduce one type of taco. And the idea was to have this really soul food to Mexicans. It was like not just comfort food, but something that you are really attached to. We sort of gourmetize them. So it's like a dish, like a complex dish, structured and everything, with this first grade ingredients, but we put a tortilla underneath and we try to make sense out of it. And you get a ribeye taco, that's something that we all know, but we add the chicharrón, which is like the scratchings of the ribeye, already crunchy. And then we add figs and a spread of ate, which is like a Mexican sweet jelly traditional candy combined with red chilies. And after that, we add pico de gallo with choconostle, which is a small acidic cacti. And so you end up with a gourmet taco that has a base of something that you already know, but a combination of ingredients that we try to surprise people so it surprises you. And as Nick was saying, we have a whole tasting of them that goes from river taco with crayfish to rabbit carnitas, passing through suadero, which is something popular on the street, but we add salsa from the peninsula of Yucatan, ribeye, pork belly, and then finally a fruit dessert taco with vanilla, with papantla vanilla and mamey cream, a honey tortilla. So what we have here, it's a food that you recognize and you don't see as pretentious, but it's got its complexity to them. Yeah, it's a first tasting taco menu that I've seen in a restaurant this type.
And that really says a lot about what this place is, because the building itself is sort of a rethinking. It's a traditional colonial building that's also modern at the same time. So I think even before you started with your menu, when you were fixing up this 300-year-old building and you left elements of the original architecture and brought in some modern touches, modern lighting, and you really integrated it well. I think that's a very hard thing to do.
So a specific question about that I've been dying to ask, because I've been in buildings of similar age, but is there a date or a date that you use to kind of when the building was, the construction started or finished historically?
Well, unfortunately, the files for most of the buildings in the first quarter of downtown, they burned. And so we lost track of exactly who made them, what sort of style is every single building or facade. But the architect that held here, he was restoring all of this monuments and buildings, and they calculated 3.5 to 4 centuries for this building.
So we're talking 17-something? So 1600s, the time of Rembrandt and the time that maybe before the pilgrims came.
The time of the Renaissance in Italy is when it was starting here. This is a little bit later than that. I mean, maybe more the time of Bach, but nevertheless, it's old.
And we were being colonized, and actually the street that we were sitting, and it was a street called the Canal Street, and it was water. It wasn't a street. We know in this block, the IRS of those times for the Spanish crown lived in this block. Later on, it became like a casona, which is like a big house designed for people to get in by horse. And then we lost track of what it was.
But then the first use you're saying was maybe a storeroom or a counting room, or?
It should have been like a house. It should have been a big house for people that were living in this part. And then centuries later, it became commerce. We know some small part of it. That's the part where we connect to Café de Tacuba. That was the first psych ward in the country, which was the hospital of the Divino Salvador, which is the Divine Savior. And that was the first hospital to be treating patients with mind illnesses. So we know that part, but then again, where we're having this conversation, we don't really know because it was burned, but we know it's old. And that is the buildings is what tells us the age of it. And it's also the reason for the name of the restaurant, Limosneros. I got it from the walls. So they nicknamed these walls at that time Muros de Limosna, because the church used to ask people for stone materials in order to build up churches, monasteries, all these sort of Catholic
religious buildings.
Religious buildings, exactly. And people were to chip in with tesontle or volcanic stone, cantera, madoquin, tabique. All of these stones were put together in this collage to make this strong, thick walls that have all of these textures. So we recover them. We try to make them very evident in the place. And we try to have the same language in the design for the place. So we use a lot of volcanic stones, like the ones, our lamps, for example, old wood, Talavera from Puebla. Since the walls are very gray and heavy to the site, we try to have the most colorful art that we can get in Mexico, which is, for me, we call art. And it's so colorful that it really stands out from the Limosneros wall, or Muros de Limosna.
I'm going to pull this all together. We're in an old part of town in an old country, and we're in an old building that has been adapted, and we are now serving very, very modern food using the word you used earlier, the patrimony of the country. We are using the most authentic ingredients to create the most modern of dishes.
But all based on tradition.
What I would ask you to do at this point, I think we've had the conversation about food and ingredients that I wanted to have. I would ask you, both of you, in a sense, to plug the restaurant. But if someone came here, you've talked about some of the dishes, but how should they think about the menu? And if they're not coming to Mexico City and they're just thinking about Mexican food, if you have any thoughts or wisdom as well. But I'd really like to focus on the food here.
This is Mexican food. I think that's what we want people outside of Mexico to know, that Mexican food is a very, very complex thing. And I write about street food, and I also write about high-end restaurants like this. And we hope that people will come here and with an open mind and want to try everything. You're coming here to a Mexican restaurant, but you're not going to find, other than those high-end tacos, you're not going to find things that you would think. You're not going to find any nachos, and you're not going to find any enchiladas or anything like that. But it's all part of Mexican food, and we're trying to expand people's minds, both in the country and visitors.
Yeah, that's exactly what we intend to do. And we've talked about food, but this actually, it all started too with the focus on Mexican distilled spirits and fermented drinks. And we try to have a great selection of artisanal mezcals, of craft beer. You know what Mexican craft beer can achieve, because we're famous for all those brands that you have in mind right now. But there's really a lot of enthusiasm for making much better beer, much better spirits, especially wine right now. It's becoming much more popular in Mexico. We've eradicated all of the mistakes that we had before due to our terroir in Baja California.
And our political history, in which during the Spanish colonial era, wine growing, other than for clerical reasons, was banned. So we didn't have a wine industry here to speak of until the past 20 or 30 years. In Baja California, on the coast, it's really exploded. It's amazing what they're producing, and even in some areas of the interior of the country. And your bar features everything Mexican. Is that true?
Exactly. All of the labels of wine are Mexican, so everything that you pick should be a boutique wine. So no big industrialized wine either, and not even if it's Mexican.
Fantastic. I want to pause a little bit about talking about the liquor and the wine, because I want to do a separate little recording about that. But it's very important that we mentioned it now, because it is part of what this restaurant is and what you offer. Again, you had given me a beer earlier that was absolutely fantastic. Could you mention what beer that was, by the way?
Oh, you had a double IPA from Ensenada called Astillero by Aguamala Brewery.
All right. Fantastic. Highly recommended. Now, putting the alcohol aside, we'll come back to it. It was important for me to make sure we mention it, because it is part of what you do here. Again, if I came in, if I'm in Mexico City, if I'm lucky enough to be here, I'm coming into Limoneros for lunch or dinner. How should I think about your menu? What should I look at? How should I think about it?
Well, at first you'd be confused, but that's what we intend to do too. The thing is, we don't have a really big menu. We try to replace dishes every time that we change it year by year. There's entries that are fresh, like a fresh fish ceviche from Mexico, from Ensenada. Then you can get some insects to see if you like them, because I like to tell my clientele that if you don't like them here, you don't like them elsewhere.
That's true.
And then some protein. We have organic meats, we have fish, we have octopus, and then the seasonal menus. And that would be like a complete tryout for the...
Is there one thing I should not miss?
If you're adventurous enough, the cocopachos you shouldn't miss, or the escamoles.
But there's also a tasting menu for people who can't make up their minds. You always have a what you call degustación, isn't
yes.
that right? That's how many courses? Six?
The chef's tasting menu.
The chef's tasting menu. So.
And it changes every month, and it's six courses plus the petit fours can be paired. Or you can have the taco tasting menu, which is also six. And it can also be paired with, not with wine, but with mezcals and craft beer. So yeah, it's a different...
But the most important thing is to come with an open mind and try new ingredients, new flavors.
We're about to come to an end of this recording, but we're going to be right back immediately and just talk a little bit about tequila and mezcal. So if you're listening to this now, look for the link in the show notes, and we'll have a bunch of other things. But if you could tell us where we are, the address, how to find it, all of the things that people might want to know.
So we are located in the heart of downtown Mexico City. The street name's called, the street name's Allende, numbers 3. And we are located a few steps from Tacuba Street. We are really close to Bellas Artes, Fine Arts Palace, and an emblematic building of the city. Very beautiful one too. And you can locate us in the number 5521-5576. The Twitter is @LimosnerosMX. Our Facebook page is Limosneros. The webpage is limosneros.com.mx.
And you can read my review at goodfoodmexicocity.com. Just look for Limosneros, www.goodfoodmexicocity.com.
This is Harry Hawk, and this has been Talking About Everything. I hope everybody has a great day. Bye-bye.
My name is Chuck Fresh, and I am being paid to thank you for listening to Talking About Everything with Harry Hawk. Harry wants to hear from you on Twitter at HHawk or HarryHawk@gmail.com. And now, a word from our sponsor, Life Extension Coach, and favorite chef. Hawk Digital Marketing is focused on bringing brands and people together. We build communities of interest based on trust and transparency, where consumers and brands can converse, learn, discuss, or solve problems together, while creating a long-term connection, entanglement, between you and your customers. Once connected, we help you engage, communicate, sell, present, educate, and inform. Evolve your communications with us. HawkSocialMarketing.com.